Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we've got trade news and trade rumors. Is James Harden on the move? Is Darius Garland going to be a Los Angeles Clipper? What does DeAndre Hunter look like in Sacramento? Did the Cleveland Cavaliers get better acquiring Dennis Schroeder and Keon Ellis? The Bulls doing smart things on the edges of a trade. We like that. From there, we talk about the All-Star reserves. They were announced. Do we agree with the selections? What does an All-Star selection even mean? How important should it be? We have a philosophical conversation about that. And then we talk about some of our favorite defensive trends of the season, lead-wide things, things we like certain teams that are doing. We talk about zone and the different ways that it can shape itself. And then from there, we recap the unrivaled weekend, record-setting attendance in Philadelphia on Friday night, some entertaining games, Paige Peckers, electric, Marina Mabry, record-setting. Are the Rose okay? Are the Vinyl finding themselves? How good is this missed offense? We talk about that and more on this episode of The Dunker Spot. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, heavy trade deadline week. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Ready to talk some hoop. Ready to talk some trades. Ready to talk some James Harden.
Because to peel the curtain back, we were slated to talk a whole lot of defense today. We're going to kick off defense week. We had some trends thoughts. Later in the week, we're going to get into some war stuff. We're still going to do that. But late on Monday night, we get from Chris Mannix that the Clippers and the Cavaliers are having some conversations, and not just any conversations, conversations around James Harden and Darius Garland, to which I'm like, what on earth do you mean? James Harden, who's been out the last two games with personal reasons, is on the trade block. And apparently there have been discussions for a while now between Harden and the Clippers. A lot of this seems to stem from, I am James Harden. I am very good. I am also turning 37 soon. I would like a little bit more security financially. And the Clippers are like, yes, you are good. We value you. You have been a big part of this turnaround. I think 17-5 in their last 22 games. However, we do want to make sure our books are clear headed into the 26-27 season or into that offseason. So we don't really want to do that. And here we are, Steve, at a bit of an impasse, with potential trade talk happening now. Where do you start with this?
Well, here's the thing. We say impasse. This feels like the least messiest of the James Harden trade portion of the program. Because James Harden was like, hey, I'll take less money. Let's get more people in here and make this better for us. And the more people showed up, and it didn't go much better at the start. And he held it down, and then the whole Chris Paul thing happened, and then Kawhi came back and started hooping, and the Clippers started winning. But it's also like, okay, this is cool. But as a reminder, I did take less money, and I would like more money. And the Clippers are like, well, yeah, but no. And he's like, okay, well, I'd like to leave if that's possible. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, it makes sense. James Harden is an elite talent, even at this advanced stage of his career. He's one of the best players we've ever seen in the league. And so it becomes interesting. We talked about the Ja Morant trade market. Now James Harden's available. Who makes that swing? I don't know what was more stunning to me, Nikias, the fact that it was like James Harden and the Clippers are working on a trade, or the Cavs were immediately mentioned, because I did not foresee that. I did not see that coming. Because Cleveland kind of felt like, boy, this sure has been a year. I think we're okay. And it's like, maybe we're not okay. Let's do something else. So I don't know. I don't know if you felt the same way, but it's like they've got, we need to try to win a championship. We've got second apron stuff. We've got a core that, I don't know. This year's been weird. I don't know, man.
It's a weird spot. Like, I did feel similarly when Cleveland was brought up, because the first thing that I saw was Harden Garland. And I was just like, wait a minute, wait. For both of y'all. One, why is Harden available? Two, Darius Garland being, like, shopped isn't a super surprise, largely because of the health stuff with him. He just has not been healthy over the last year and a half. And so I understood if there's going to be a piece of the core that Cleveland decides to trade, it's going to be Garland or it's going to be Jared Allen, which just saw a tweet before we started recording that the Cavs are also exploring trade options for Jared Allen as well. So that would track. So less surprised about Garland. Those two for each other is where I was like, hold on. What do you mean? And I thought a little bit more about it. I'm just like, well, if the Clippers do want to transition into a new era at some point, because like I do think we are towards the end of the Kawhi Harden era. Didn't think this was going to be a hard trade, but either way, feel like we're coming to the end of that. It makes sense to get the younger Darius Garland in the building when he is upright. He is one of the best point guards that we have in the league. Dynamic pull-up shooter, really good floater, incredible playmaker. Like, it makes sense to trend younger, and this is a guy that will help your team when healthy. And also, he has the type of play style, the type of passing ability that other players would want to be around. So, like, it makes sense as a building block. For the Cavs, if we are trying to win right now, James Harden right now is better than Darius Garland. He has been better than Darius Garland this year. And again, health stuff obviously plays into that. But like Harden is the better player right now. So if this is just let's maximize this window, we really need to get past the second round before Donovan Mitchell starts looking around. I can understand the logic of getting a more win now piece in James Harden, who, you know, you size up a little bit in the backcourt. A Cleveland team that wants to switch, you could do that a little bit easier with Harden compared to Garland. At least in theory, you can. So I was like, okay, I'm starting to get this. And then you get some of the reporting that Cleveland's like, yeah, we're trading Darius Garland. We would also like a pick since there is like a 10-year difference between the two. And the Clippers are like, well, no, James Harden is, I would imagine, like, no, James Harden is better than him. Why am I giving you compensation for this? Y'all are also second apron teams. Like, James Harden has the player option, but it's a partial guarantee. Like, why am I giving you a pick in something like this? I don't think so. So I don't know how that Vince is going to be mended in the next day and a half, or if it's going to do that. But the on-court fit is, I mean, the on-court swap is, it makes some sense, but it's still just shocking to me that we are here this quickly and this randomly.
Well, I mean, I think when you look at it, if you're Cleveland in this specific Eastern Conference, right, with what you've been building, you put yourself in a decent enough spot, not the one you thought you'd be in. You probably thought you'd be Detroit. Worst case, you probably thought you'd be New York. Worst case, you probably thought you'd be Boston. You are close to that. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have an opportunity to swing for the fences. So if this is the chance, the time is now. We have enough data to tell us, okay, our core, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but we can't keep all four of them on the court at the same time. They have enough data to know that they can't keep all four of them on the court at the same time. It's unfortunate, but okay, we need to pivot. So if you get James Harden and you are able to try and take a swing in this Eastern Conference, you're telling me James Harden and Donovan Mitchell can't get to the conference finals with the way that Donovan Mitchell's played, with the playmaking and scoring ability of James Harden? Does that not shift the needle for Cleveland with his ability to play in pick and roll, with his ability to isolate and score, with his ability to drive the basketball? We've talked about Cleveland looking to see who can get in the paint, who can get paint touches. James Harden has shown that at times, and he'll have a Donovan Mitchell who does a whole lot of that. And, you know, it's funny because James Harden was looking for the Clippers to add more pieces so he did not have to do as much, and the pieces were gone. So if James Harden goes to Cleveland within that offensive system, within their pace and their tempo and the way they play, does that elevate them? Does that elevate him? Can they make a run in the Eastern Conference? That's where it gets very interesting. Now, I don't know if another team is involved. Like, all we know is, all we've heard is Harden. They're working towards it. Cleveland might be a piece. I'm not sure. The Garland portion, if you're the Clippers, makes sense because, okay, if we are pivoting, if this is the end of an era, which is funny because I feel like it's, you kind of get these trades between two teams that are like, this is the end of what we tried to do. Would you like to make a trade for one of these pieces? But if you're the Clippers, you get Darius Garland and you have a high level talent that you can continue to move upwards with, because it's going to be hard to pivot from James Harden. Just like for Cleveland, it's going to be hard to pivot from just having the four pieces and now trying to add to it. But I think if James Harden goes to Cleveland, they become a real, real factor in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, like it gets, oh man, like the non-Mitchell minutes being James Harden creation just seems like a fun time, but like also the non-Mitchell minutes with healthy Darius Garland is a fun time. Like, it just kind of makes me sad to the end of era a bit, where it's just like, man, don't want to see the Clippers season end, well, this era end the way that it has, especially since they are trending up after the god-awful start. And I think I'm glad that you kind of framed the conversation early on, Steve, about James Harden taking less money. Let's add in more talent. You have the Chris Paul thing. You have the Bradley Beal injury. And it's like, okay, John now, but like there was a little bit of inconsistency in terms of, okay, what does it look like when he's the four or at the five? What is the Lopez piece looking like? And so like I can understand James Harden be like, well, if I took less to do this and I'm playing this well, I want this money back. And Clippers like, well, we respect you, but no, at least not yet. Let's get to the Austin, you know? So that's, I appreciate you layering that context. As far as the suitors bit, because as you mentioned, like this has very much been Clippers Cavs focus right now. From the reporting that we have right now, the Wolves had discussions, but they are more focused in on whatever's going to happen with Giannis, whether it's at the deadline or when we get into the offseason. We'll see what happens there. Toronto Raptors. Yeah,
that makes sense. Hey, yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Just give us a minute. Give us some time. Sorry, we'll get back now, to why,
yeah. Now, while we can use a guard, this is Giannis. So let's see if we can do that first. And if not, we'll circle back. The Raptors and the Pelicans have reportedly reached out. James Harden does not appear to have much interest in joining the Raptors or the Pelicans. And Harden doesn't have a literal no trade clause, but because he re-signed with 1 year and has the player option, he does have like a de facto like trade veto powers with his deal. So if he is not interested in Toronto or New Orleans, which the New Orleans piece really is interesting to me, like this feels like let's get off of some of the money that we have, we can give y'all more depth.
New Orleans is in James a weird Harden, place. New Orleans is in a weird place because I feel like they have pieces that teams want, like pieces that teams would want to add to their team, but at the same time, they don't want to just do anything. So it's like, hey, man, James Harden, sure. And James Harden's like, I do not want to go there. That's
fine. James Harden opens the NBA app, sees where the Pelicans are in the standings, and just says, absolutely not.
Yeah, I won't be going there.
I think what, further south?
How do you feel about the Toronto portion of this? Do you think they should, as a great man once said, do you think they should get involved with this?
I'm gonna get involved with that. Oh my. I wouldn't mind it from Toronto. Like, it's weird for them to pop up now because Emmanuel Quickley is now playing much better than he was to start the season. But like, this is still James Harden, and the Raptors do have experience trading for a future Hall of Famer that has expressed that they may not want to be there long term, and so it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility for them to say, actually, yeah, we hear you. We have assets and we have picks, and we think you can be the piece that puts us over the top in this Eastern Conference that Detroit has set themselves apart. So I don't want to say wide open, but we feel like we can defend Detroit. And if James Harden helps our half court offense, because Toronto, as much as I have enjoyed them and enjoy what they want to do structurally offensively, they face good teams and the offense does not do what it needs to do. They don't generate enough threes. They don't make enough threes. It gets kind of cramped. James Harden can help with all of that in theory. So, like, I certainly understand the Toronto interest. Like, I'll be intrigued that they actually, like, we're going to put real stuff on the table and dare you to say no. I don't know if it's gotten to that stage with them. But I would be intrigued by that. And frankly, if they could get off of at least one of the long-term contracts that they probably don't want on their books to get a deal done, like, it's probably worth for them to do the short-term bit anyway, just to clear the cap situation.
Well, is the Raptors saga just ending in Domantas Sabonis? Is that just going to be the bit, Nikias?
There's been so much smoke around that. I guess we'll see over the next day and a half, but that wouldn't shock me. They seem to really be interested in him. It feels like there's a Mark Stein / Jake Fisher report every other day that, hey, if it's going to happen for the Kings, it's probably going to be Toronto. So we'll just see what happens on that front. Before we move to the actual trades that have happened, is there a suitor that intrigues you for James Harden that we haven't mentioned?
It gets tricky, again, because a lot of teams are having success. And when you come to the point guard position or, you know, the heavy playmaker position, if you're playing well, are you going to break down your team to get a talent that while you respect and enjoy and know could help you? Are you going to alter your course? That's where it gets tricky. That's where I've had trouble with the John Morant trade market. I had trouble with the Trae Young trade market. And I have more trouble with the James Harden trade market. It's like, who is in a position to make the swing to really get the deal? Because you need to move a piece to get it done. I don't like, you know, I mean, Portland wouldn't add James Harden. Like, how many wild card teams are in this? And so I think when it comes to Cleveland, there has to be like a sense of urgency because you need to win, because you need to keep Donovan Mitchell around, because everything changes and switches if you're in a position where you have lost again and Donovan Mitchell is like, hey, I would like to leave this situation. Mm-hmm. And so how do they navigate that portion of the program? Because you got a core four. Evan Mobley's going to be there. You may have to break up the core four to keep Donovan Mitchell because Donovan Mitchell's played so well. But Donovan Mitchell could ultimately knock on the door and be like, hey, it's been fun. What are we doing? And so this is like, this is the trade you make. You get a star talent. You build towards it. You have to have success. These windows close quicker than ever now, Nikias. And what do you do? Mm-hmm. With your, like, what do you do with it?
Yeah, it's, oh boy, the road to contention is an accelerated path depending on who you are and where you're at. Also, what if Detroit's just a wild card? It's like, hey, let's just get another creator next, Gabe Cunningham. We got salary, we got picks too. Let's just do that. Nah, man. Solve the half court thing.
Absolutely not. We are the big dogs in the Eastern Conference. We're not doing a thing.
what if we could be bigger dogs? Okay, fair enough. Well, Cavs adjacent. Let's talk about something that they actually did over the weekend, Steve. Mm-hmm. We got a trade between the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Sacramento Kings, and because the Kings can't be involved with a trade that doesn't feature the Chicago Bulls, the Bulls are in here too. So the Cavs getting Dennis Schroeder and Keon Ellis. The Kings are getting DeAndre Hunter. The Chicago Bulls, stealthy, 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 getting Dario Saric from the Sacramento Kings, absorbing that contract, a 2027 second-round pick coming from Denver, and a 2029 second-round pick. It is the worst of Detroit, Milwaukee, and New York to bridge all of those teams together from the previous conversation. So there's your three-teamer. Let's start with the Cavs since we're already in Cleveland. Steve, how do you feel about the Dennis Schroeder and Keon Ellis fits in Cleveland? Do you like the move from their perspective?
Well, I mean, I think it was Cleveland trying to add to their team. And when you look at what we talked about preseason with DeAndre Hunter and the way they were trying to use him and trying to move him across the board and have him be more involved and more post-ups, more pick and roll, more elbow usage. We had Lonzo Ball. This trade feels like, okay, the things that we thought we were going to get, let's make sure that we get it. Like, let's put this in the box of we need to get these things from these players. And so Dennis Schroeder, we know what he can do. The issue is not Dennis Schroeder's talent. The issue always becomes Dennis Schroeder on a team that needs him to elevate them as opposed to Dennis Schroeder being a part of a machine and making it better. And so I think, you know, we've seen it with the Pistons run. Like, there's multiple runs where we've seen Dennis Schroeder have an impact. And I think he fits with what Cleveland wants to do. And I think, you know, the ability to play with multiple guards, the pace, the tempo, you know, my brain automatically went to that Pistons run. It's like, remember how good Dennis Schroeder was for them? Can he now replicate that in Cleveland? I think he can. And Cleveland has needed the guard play. They've needed someone to get downhill. They needed someone to kind of be a playmaker and score. But the fun part for Cleveland is they don't need him to a degree, if that makes sense. And that's always the best case scenario for Dennis Schroeder, no disrespect. Keon Ellis, going to give you the defense. You already know that. He can space the floor. He's improved there. He can attack and beat closeouts. And so Keon Ellis is going to give you the dynamic version of, okay, what we thought DeAndre Hunter was going to do or what we thought Lonzo Ball was going to do, Keon Ellis can do every single night. We can build for that in the future. So if you're able to now have a little bit more versatility come playoff time, that helps you out. I think Keon Ellis is probably the prize of the trade, but they'll appreciate what Dennis Schroeder brings with his competitive nature and his scoring. So I think the DeAndre Hunter thing had just kind of hit the ceiling to a degree. Mm-hmm. And Nikias, you know, I was a huge fan of what DeAndre Hunter brought to the table, especially with how they were trying to use him in different ways in Cleveland, but it just kept descending to a certain degree. And instead of having one player, you have two players who can do exactly what you needed from the pieces that you added. So when it comes to DeAndre Hunter, I enjoyed what he did for Cleveland. He had the size, he had the mindset, he had the scoring ability, he kind of fit in. But as they tried to elevate his role in Cleveland, it just it never felt like it had the impact. Defenses never necessarily changed how they viewed him, and then the production didn't stay the same. And so at a certain point, what do you do with that? Especially when he now, with injuries, becomes someone who you need to play at a certain level. And you remember, we go back to last year, hey, is he a starter? He's a sixth man. He started, now he's off the bench, and now, okay, we've given you kind of the keys. It hasn't necessarily worked out. We can't afford that, especially right now for Cleveland. So, you know, I don't know if it's an indictment on DeAndre Hunter, the player, but if we can turn that into two players that can give us a little bit more depth, a little bit more versatility, I think that wins out.
Okay. I think that is all fair, Steve. I would say, if I go like 20-second rant real quick, can we like officially define what a 3-and-D player is, what the threshold is to be a 3-and-D player? Because so much of the framing around DeAndre Hunter being 3-and-D, like, he's been a fine three-point shooter for his career. He hasn't been an elite one. And to your point, like, that efficiency has dipped this year. And the defense, like, I've never really been a fan. Like, he is solid on ball, can defend one, maybe two positions. He's been a pretty rough off-ball defender his entire career. So it's just like, I don't know. Like, when the Cleveland trade happened, we talked through it. I was like, I see the theory of what this can be. I think DeAndre Hunter can help. But, like, because of the rebounding, I have issues with how much he'd be able to play the four. Like, we'll see what this part looks like. And so I didn't expect things to dip the way that it has following the first 2 weeks of the season, to where, to your point, here are more design looks early in games to get you going, get you these shots to help expand what the offensive role is and expand like how many ways we can attack overall. And that's just like, huh. So I think it's good work, to your point, Steve, that Cleveland was able to turn DeAndre Hunter into two pieces that can help. I think Keon Ellis, with his ability to defend, his ability to knock down shots, should be helpful. I am curious to see, as Cleveland makes their way to the playoffs, how our team's going to treat Keon Ellis as a shooter. Is he going to be defended similarly to some of the other wings that they've had in the past, where you need them to knock down shots? Because we are more worried about Donovan Mitchell and, I guess, insert star guard that's going to be next to Donovan Mitchell, whether that is Darius Garland or James Harden or anyone else, we'll see. I'm curious about that part. And to the Dennis Schroeder portion, the drives are going to be so helpful for this group, because I think that is one of the many things they've missed from like the Ty Jerome experience last year to this year, with as they kind of cycle through different guards this year. They've missed someone that on every night, we know this guy can put 2 feet in the paint. He can get downhill and finish for himself or draw fouls or just get the defense in rotation. And that helps us get up high quality threes with the volume that we want to. And so I was looking at some of the drive numbers for Cleveland this year and seeing how good of a driving team they are with Donovan Mitchell on the floor, what they look like when he's not on the floor, and what they've looked like when, you know, Mitchell's been on the bench, Garland's been on the bench or out, since Garland's been out since, I think, January 14th. And, like, the efficiency drop between Donovan Mitchell being on the floor as a driver and every other iteration is stark enough to where, like, yeah, man, we need to find the rim pressure somewhere. Like, I am a fan of Craig Porter Jr. That's why, like, I was kind of clamoring for it. Let's get him some more playing time early in the year, where it seemed clear Lonzo Ball was still working his way back. The rim pressure from Lonzo just wasn't going to be there, which, brief aside there, it looks like Cleveland is really working hard to send him somewhere to kind of clear a little bit more luxury tax room or apron room. So we'll see if he's moved to Washington or another team that has some cap space or an exception to bring him in. But if you can add Dennis Schroeder, and to bounce off what you said earlier, Steve, in a situation where you don't need him, you don't need him to start, you just need him to give you quality minutes. If he's playing well enough, he can close for you. I feel like that's a helpful context for him and his specific skill set, particularly the drive portion of the program, should just help this Cleveland offense, especially when they don't have Donovan Mitchell. So I love that portion for them.
Well, I mean, I think for Cleveland, you also had this season from Jalen Tyson. And so if Jalen Tyson is doing this and DeAndre Hunter is doing that, how do we view that? How do we accept that? I think that gets a little tricky. But the 3-and-D portion, I just, you know, you guys can't turn, like, everyone, you can't turn on every archetype that exists in basketball. Are you someone that can play defense? Cool. Are you someone that, you know, can make threes? Cool. I think it's less that is, like, what you do, and more like, okay, you're not a pure playmaker. You're not a pure scorer. You're going to be in a situation where we need you to play defense, and we need you to make open shots. and we need you to drive closeouts. I would just simplify it as opposed to racking your brain as a, well, you're only shooting 33% from three and you can only guard. Why? Don't live that way. You don't have to live that way. Look at me.
You
don't have to live
that way. You know, that's true. We don't have to live that way. I just, you know, I feel like if you're going to be placed in an archetype, there's a threshold you need to hit to be in that. That's all I'm saying. We're not going to spend 8 minutes racking through that. To the king side, Steve. As the Kings have naturally been panned for this deal, I was trying to think through the logic for the Sacramento Kings on this. I think on a very basic level, if you look at their roster pre this trade, they just needed someone that was like 6'7", 6'8", in the wing room, because they just really didn't have that. And so like DeAndre Hunter very much fits that portion of the program. And on the high end, he is someone that could be a strong on-ball defender and someone that can knock down shots and occasionally post up a point guard. And so, like, there is talent there. There's still age on his side on that front. And I think to the contract perspective, you are adding money next year, but you are losing a year of, like, contract commitment since he has the year next year. Dennis Schroeder has 2 years after this. So, like, you are kind of shaving it on back end to that way. So that's some of the logic there. But, like, overall, it's less about DeAndre Hunter for me and more why did you give Dennis Schroeder 3 years, where it feels like every team that gives Dennis Schroeder like a just a new contract 3 months in, they're like, ooh, why did we do this? And so you also signing up for this was interesting. We talked about this during the offseason where, yeah, we're willing to give up Malik Monk in order to be able to bring Dennis Schroeder in. It's like, well, I don't know if you need to do that. Like, I think Malik probably is just better, like different skill sets, obviously. But like, okay, why are we doing that? So you do this, and then you have the Keon Ellis chip where so many teams have expressed some level of interest in Keon Ellis because of what he could do as a defender, the shot making, also young. Like, his growth in Sacramento has been one of the more underrated stories in the league. And for him to essentially be part of a deal to bring you DeAndre Hunter, it just feels kind of underwhelming for that to be the way that you could do that. Where I feel like a Keon Ellis trade by himself probably could have netted you more, because I don't think Sacramento got any pick compensation out of this deal. Like, it's just Hunter for them. So that part feels weird. But I do think there is an on-court fit for DeAndre Hunter here.
So this is the fun of doing this podcast with you. You know how I feel about groupthink. I don't like it. So if everyone's going to thumbs down the Sacramento Kings, I may agree and understand, but if everyone's nodding and saying the same thing, what conversation are we having? We might as well go get a sandwich. Yeah. Let's go have some lunch. What are we doing? So I think the thing for me with Sacramento is, hey, we want Dennis Schroeder. We also want Russell Westbrook. We don't really want Malik Monk anymore, and Keon Ellis is not going to play. They had an ideal guard situation and no vision for that. I can agree and get down with that. There's no debate there. If you look at what this move is, you have to start with either, well, or this didn't work, or I've made a mistake. And don't go too much further if you don't want to get mad. So I think this for Sacramento is an admission that, okay, the Dennis Schroeder thing did not work for us. We have to pivot away from that. We need to pivot away from a lot of these things that we have going on and try something else. You can tumble down the road about how they got here. I understand. But we have a piece that is younger than most of the pieces we have to a degree, and either will help us or can be tradable down the line and is not what we've had. The Keon Ellis portion, they just didn't value him to a certain degree. It was pretty clear by his playing time and everything that happened. Yeah. They didn't necessarily see him as a piece of the next run. And, you know, you can yell at them about that, I understand. But that happens in the league where certain players contribute to your success, but you don't necessarily understand that they are a core of your success, as opposed to, okay, we're playing well, you helped us, let's move on from it. So that's where it gets tricky for me. I don't necessarily blame anyone for torching the Kings on the move, but we've all had friends that have made unfortunate decisions. And, you know, are you, when you help them move, are you yelling at them for why you're helping them move? No, you're lugging that couch up.
Just helping them move,
right?
Yeah, I think you always have the best analogies on this stuff. I think the frustration lies in which, why have I moved six couches in the last in the last 2 years? I think that's where it's like, hey, man, we need to, no more rooms to go for you. Like, let's leave this alone. Okay, while we're on the news, we're going to move to All-Star. I just like to quickly say, Atlanta, Portland, their deal, Veet Krejci, now a Portland Trailblazer, they needed the shooting very badly in the room. And I think adding another wing that can knock down shots and do so off movement should help that Portland offense, should loosen the shackles of the half-court offense in particular, especially with some of the attention that Denny Abdia sees. Now, the All-Star reserves were announced, Steve. We have the East, we have the West, we have some snubs we can talk through, but very quickly, the East reserves, as selected by the coaches, Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Johnson, Karl Anthony Towns, Pascal Siakam, Norm Powell, Scotty Barnes, Jalen Duren, you are all in. And in the Western Conference, Anthony Edwards, Jamal Murray, Chet Holmgren, Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Denny Avdija, and LeBron James. So starting with, actually, let's start with the West. I think that is where most of the conversation is coming, I would imagine. LeBron James, selected by the coaches, Steve. We didn't have to see if someone else was selected and Adam Silver gave him the ceremonial spot, a la Dwayne Wade, Dirk Nowitzki that year. LeBron James just in. Are you surprised that the coaches had LeBron just firmly in?
No, and I'm happy it went that way. And if this is the last one for him, I'm glad that he got selected and was put in as opposed to injury replacement, even if he doesn't play. Like, I'm just, my thing was, I asked the question a bunch of times in the buildup, trying to prepare for a world where LeBron James was an all-star because we just hadn't seen it, and we're not there. Legends get send-offs. I'm sorry. It happens. Mm-hmm. Dr. J, Kareem, Magic Johnson got voted in the All-Star game. He wasn't even in the league. Like, this is a part, Michael Jordan, Mariah Carey was singing. This is a part of the program. And I would much rather be on the side where LeBron gets a proper send-off, whether he plays or not. And you know, we can salute a legend. You only get one chance at that. We can yell and scream about All-Star games for the rest of our lives. You only get one chance to send a legend off. And so I don't really have a problem with LeBron being named an All-Star. I know there were other deserving candidates. I thought James Harden had a heck of a year. I thought Kawhi Leonard just played well. There are players that have done good things. The coaches gave the salute to LeBron. What are you going to do about it?
Yell and scream on the podcast. No, in all seriousness, like, I think that is a fair and understandable perspective to have. I think for me, it goes back to my base complaint when it comes to these things. We need to figure out how much an all-star selection actually means. My thing has always been, if this is just for the fans and this is just, let's get our favorite players in, to your point, legendary send-offs, then I don't want to hear all-star selection cited as like part of Hall of Fame resumes and things. If they are going to be cited as such, or if they're like contract incentives tied to all-star selections and things like that, then okay, let's take it more seriously. I am legitimately fine with either one, but I have always been annoyed by the middle ground of it matters, but it doesn't kind of matter in this case, but it does matter because of this. I don't like that gray area. And so for me, as a basketball fan, I'm with you. I want LeBron to have whatever ceremony or whatever send-off that he can have, because this is one of the greatest players of all time. He has been a huge part of my childhood as a basketball fan. I've learned a ton by watching LeBron James, especially when he was a member of the Miami Heat as someone that grew up as a Heat fan. So, like, I am here for the celebration. However, I also have, hey, this player is an X-time All-Star, X-time All-NBA, yada, yada. It's part of the Hall of Fame thing. So then when I look at it through that lens, I don't think LeBron James has been a top 12 player in the conference this year. And so I have, if we are, again, if it matters, if there's money tied to it, there's Hall of Fame stuff tied to it, yeah, I have a problem with LeBron getting in over a Kawhi, who's been better than him this year, a James Harden, who's been better than him this year, Julius Randle, who's been better than him this year, Alperen Şengün, who's been better than this year. For me, it's less about LeBron specifically and more, what does the selection mean? Because I think we are well aware, the game itself, we've had 17 format changes in the last 10 years. Like, the game itself is what it is. We need to figure out what an all-star selection means and how much value that has to it. If it is something, we got to take it more seriously.
Why?
Because what do you mean?
Life is not black and white, Nikias. It's gray. Every year that all-stars happen, selections, it's a different year. It's a different season. There's a different reason people get picked and selected. Everyone got mad because, oh, how could Pascal Siakam be named an All-Star and the Pacers haven't won? No one knows their history. They don't know the Orlando Magic and the Charlotte Hornets were in the Western Conference at one time. They don't know that Alvin Robertson was voted as an All-Star starter and the team was really bad in 1987. I don't understand the logic of that because that's not how the world works. It's not an indictment on the seriousness of an All-Star selection. It's a snapshot of what happened that season. That's what it is. And we don't have to copy and paste it as this whole thing to unfurl and get all riled up about. Because do you remember every All-Star in their record when they were announced? Do you remember every season? You just know they were an All-Star.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's fair, yeah.
So why are we getting so just raw about this all the time? If you go back to All-Star selections in the past, you don't have the same energy. A, because you weren't there. B, because you don't know. Like, I don't get why we have to be like, well, this is not that serious. It has to be this, this, and that. That's not how it works. You talk through it, you make your pick, basketball subjective, and you move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an element of, if we're doing like the overall like worldview, I think there's an element of, as you learn or as you know more, you change how you go about things. And this is where, again, like I understand the world very much is gray. I think for something like this, because there is the fan element and also the money / historical relevance element to it, that's where I would like for it to be less gray. Because I think those are two very different views and two very different ways to go about selecting those kind of things, if that's going to be the case. And that's where the value systems are different. And that's where I would want some level of separation. Like, if this is for the fans, I prefer for this just to be for the fans. Like, I don't know. Like, I just don't like that middle ground. Like, I don't want players to get snubbed or lose out on money or something like that over something like this, because that matters.
Nikias, like, no matter how you split it, someone's going to get snubbed. If it's the fans' choice for all of them, someone will miss out. If it's the coach's choice for all of them, someone will miss out. That's the way it works. That's the way of the world, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Everyone can't get named an All-Star.
I know that. I think the parameters in which those... I feel like I've laid out the beef. Like, I think there are parameters that can be laid to make sure that, depending on how we are viewing the game or the selections themselves, let's make sure the people that we want or should get in. That's all I'm saying.
So who shouldn't be an All-Star?
Again, I think that depends. That's why I'm frustrated. Well, frustrated is too strong, because, like, at the end of the day, this is an All-Star game. But, like, for me, I think if Hall of Fame selections are somewhat tied to All-Star selections, or if that's somewhat tied into the resume, if money is involved, I think the players that should make the All-Star games are the players that are playing the best at the time that voting is done or selections are made. And so for me, I don't think LeBron has been a top 12 player in the conference this year. He is obviously more important historically than anyone in this game right now. Again, he is at absolute worst, he's a top 5 player of all time. Like, I don't have LeBron beef. But for me, hey, there's money tied to this. There's potential Hall of Fame stuff tied to this. Within that lens, I want this to be more merit-based, if this is going to be the bit. If that is removed, just get my favorites in. This is where my mind shifts. So again, I'm fine with either. I don't love... I agree with you that there is a gray area in this, and that's how it's played out. There's a gray area in life. You are not incorrect. I am saying, within this context, this is why I have an issue with the gray area existing. Because there is a level of seriousness tied to the other side.
But you're assuming, because people think differently, that they're not being serious. They just may have a different subjective, like, they may think differently. They may have, it's subjective. But what you'd label as non-serious just might be how they believe or their belief system in basketball. That's not a bad thing. People are different.
No, that's fair. No, that's fair. That's fair. I guess, well, we've talked through the West. Were you surprised by the Pascal inclusion while we're here?
No. I said on this podcast he would be in.
Okay.
No one taps their ears and listens to me. I almost had everyone except for I had the wrong Raptor. But no. Look, I mean, the Pascal thing is, one, he's been great, and two, hasn't been a loud Bam year, hasn't been the super loud Evan Mobley year, hasn't been the loud Paolo or Franz year. I think those factors played into him being in a position to get in, despite the Pacers' record.
Mm-hmm. That is fair. You mentioned Mobley, you mentioned Bam. You said you picked the wrong Raptor. Brandon Ingram, the Raptors are not pleased that Brandon Ingram didn't get in. The Scotty Barnes in particular was incredulous that him and Brandon didn't end up making it. No Michael Porter Jr., which I felt was interesting. I think he has just been incredibly good for the Brooklyn Nets, and they have been pretty much a neutral team with him on the floor this year, which you look at their record, that is an accomplishment in and of itself. But Pascal's been very good. And so we are going to see later on what Team A and Team B are going to be, the Team USA squads. But Team World, as of now, we have Shea, we have Luka, we have Giannis, we have Wemby, we have Jokic, we have Jamal Murray, Denny Avdia, and Pascal Siakam. Giannis naturally out with the calf strain, and we'll see if he actually gets moved. So last thing before we move to break, Steve, do you have a name for the Giannis replacement, assuming that he is not going to be available for the All-Star game?
Donovan Mitchell or Carl Anthony Towns? Just go. Cupid shuffle.
I see. Well, I guess you move one of the, you move Cat or Norm Powell or someone to Team World, and then that opens up a spot in the East. I wonder if that means you get Brandon Ingram in or Michael Porter Jr. I guess we'll see what happens on that front. But we are going to take a break, and when we return, we have some trends to talk through on the defensive side of the ball. Very excited about this. We hope you stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. And Steve, it is time to talk some defense. We talked some trends a little bit last week. Want to focus in on the defensive end, some things that we've enjoyed, some things that are perking up league-wide, some things that are team-specific that may be different from last year. Just want to talk a little bit about defense as we kick off defense week, so to speak. And I think for me, Steve, aggression has kind of been the word for me defensively this year. Like, I think back to a question that I asked Steve Clifford a few years ago in a pregame presser, and I was asking him about the state of defense and like how do you counter what teams are doing now, that more shooting, higher pick and rolls, like they're inverting actions, etc. And among the great answer that he gave, and I still have that clip out there, what he said towards the end was to the effect of, I think teams have to be more aggressive this year. Like, I don't think you can sit back anymore, just kind of play drop or whatever the case may be. Like, I think you kind of have to try to dictate terms in that regard. And so, like, looking at the league and seeing overall double team rate across the league is a little bit up from last year. Putting two on the ball and pick and roll, like, the rate of that happening across the league is going up. And this is with, as we talked about in the trends episode last week, pick and roll volume overall is going down. But the rate of teams putting two on the ball, that has gone up this year. And like one of my favorite aspects of this overall aggression dial being turned up league-wide for me this year, Steve, has been the rise of full court or just backcourt pressure. There are more teams that are willing to pick up players in the backcourt. There are more teams willing to not only just do that and just kind of have like the token thing to let you know I'm there. Like, no, we're actually getting into your jersey. We're actually trying to turn you over a couple of times. We're going to bully you. We're going to bleed clock. Ideally, we can force you into some turnovers. Like, the rise of that has been one of my favorite things about this season on the defensive end. And quickly on the numbers front on that, in that aspect, Steve, average pickup distance across the league this year, around 43 feet. That is the highest that has been logged in the Second Spectrum database. That goes back to the 2013-14 season. There are backcourt pickups on over 15% of possessions on average this year. That is the highest that we have since the 13-14 season. And there are six teams in the league, Steve, with a backcourt pickup rate over 20%. The Portland Trailblazers, who are doing so on 30% of their possessions, that is the highest in the league. They're the only team above 30, which everyone does it, even though the defense hasn't been, you know, very good in terms of defensive rating. A lot of that is injury-based, in my opinion. Jrue Holiday to pick you up full court. Tamani Kamara do it. Caleb Love will do it. Chris Murray will do it. Like, they just have a bunch of guys that are willing to pick you up in the backcourt and they add pressure on top of that. They do a very good job of forcing teams into tough decisions on that front. So they're number one. The Brooklyn Nets, the Phoenix Suns, who have been one of my favorite defenses to watch this year, they hound you early in the clock, and that kind of bleeds into some of the other things they do in the half court. We'll get there. Washington, Memphis, San Antonio, the other three teams there. So I'd kind of start with the full court pressure bit. Like, we've talked a little bit about some of the counters that we've seen this year from offenses, but that has been a major theme of the season, I feel. Teams are more willing to bring that kind of pressure.
I mean, I think the rise of full court pressure makes sense. You're trying to take tempo out of teams' game plan. You're trying to slow teams down. You're trying to take seconds off the shot clock. And I think when you're a defense, that's part of the goal. Like, I think when you think of full court pressure, a lot of times people think of, okay, we're trying to really pressure and force a turnover. But I think in today's game, this is more so, hey, I would like you to slow things down. I want you to start your set with 16 on the clock as opposed to 20 on the clock. I want you to have to do something else. I want to give the rest of my defenders a chance to be physical and deny if you're doing movement sets, or I want to take something away. So I think that's where the game becomes. It's less about the pure aggression in my eyes and more about overall, we want to just try and slow things down and get this as controllable as we can. Now, the issue becomes how many teams can execute it properly. How many teams have the personnel to execute properly? If you're an offense, how many times are you going to have someone else just bring the ball up and as a counter? And I think it gets interesting as you navigate the season, because I think teams become really aware of it. And then teams are like, oh, I have the ball in my best person's hands. We're just going to deal with that. There's high screens. There's pressure releases. How many times you can do that in the playoffs? So I think there's a lot of questions that come with it. And so I think more so the thing you've seen around the league is just trying to figure out, if everyone's playing with pace and everyone's playing with tempo and everyone's understanding that we can get early in the clock and get to multiple actions and make your defense have to sustain over 24 seconds, how can we take seconds away from you? And so I think that to me has been the overall impact of full court pressure, the overall impact of trying to do something. Because I think as you see the season wear on, yeah, there are some people that are really, really active as far as that full court pressure goes. There's some where it's just false pressure and I'm just with you, to just kind of make you go a little slower than you would have, to kind of take away the automatic throw ahead, to give our defense a chance to set. So the balance there is interesting.
No, I think the balance, to your point, the balance is interesting, and I think the balance is important. And like, one of the teams that I think fit the bill for you in that front, I think would be Toronto. That isn't in this like top six that we're doing it 20% of the time. Earlier this season, they were one of the highest rate teams in doing so. They were getting blitzed early on. Like, I still have the early Atlanta matchup in my head where you have, this is when Trae Young was still a Hawk at this point, where you have Toronto trying to set up full court pressure. And Trae's just like, all right, bet. Well, you're playing my top side. I'm going to cut this way and get a catch on the move. And now I can put your defense in rotation early on. It has been interesting to watch Toronto in particular kind of dial back. Okay, we're not doing this all the time. We're now going to make this more of like a second unit thing, or like Scotty plus bench thing. Or we are down six. Let's see if we can ramp up the pressure. Let's see if we can turn this game on its head. They've been more selective with it. And when they are at their best, they are able to kind of turn games on its head. Like, I think Toronto's done a really good job of, again, because they have Emmanuel Quickley, not a great defender, but he's willing to, you know, exude that kind of ball pressure. Jamal Shedd will definitely do it. Jacoby Walter will do it. And you have Scotty Barnes on the high end, on the back end. Like, all right, cool. You're pressuring. I'm going to blindside this dude now. Enforcing turnovers in that way. So, like, them mix again, kind of the trap element on top of this, I think has been fun. Like, Portland to sprinkle that in as well. And Phoenix, I think, has the nice blend to your point of sometimes we're doing this, we're really going to bother you, we're going to bleed clock. Other times we're just up here just to make sure you know we are here, we're going to slow you down a little bit. And then that's when Phoenix gets into their fun defense in the half court where they are super physical off the ball. There's a level of switchability to them. There's still a level of ball pressure in the half court that I think goes a little underrated. To where we're going to bother you. We don't have to blitz pick and rolls and things like that. We just kind of get into you and you can't use the screen. And then what they're doing with their bigs this year, Steve, when Osa Igudaro's in, we're more at the level. We can mix in even more switching if we want to. With Mark Williams, we'll creep him up sometimes, but also we'll have him in a drop. We'll do some of the fun cross-matching and have him on a non-shooter so we can keep him low on the floor. Like, it all kind of bleeds into that, but I do appreciate that Phoenix is able to kind of set the tone early with that high pressure, with those high pickup points. And it just kind of permeates what their defense is. Like, I think Phoenix feels like the ideal version of this, to where we will do it. We're not doing it all the time. So you can't really ding us like you can with other teams that are just doing it as often as they are.
Well, I think the thing you want to have as a defense is you want to have versatility. And so if you show something enough times, an offense is eventually going to find a counter. You have to be able to throw different things at teams. You have to be able to throw different things at star players. And so the best teams are going to be able to anticipate and dictate defensively. They're going to be able to find a way to disrupt and take you out of what you want to do, take you out of your first option, take you out of your second option, take you out of what you want to do when you're walking through things. You know, if you do have a shoot around, we want to take you out of those actions and make you do something else. Those are the best defenses. And so if you have bigs who can do multiple things, if you have guards who can contain the ball, if you have wings who can switch, you put yourself in a different stratosphere. I think that's been the biggest thing in today's NBA. The teams that have that versatility throughout the lineup, we can start one way, we sub, we continue on, our defense identity stays the same. Those teams have sustained success. And so if you look at the top defensive teams, there's a continuity that they have, right? If you look at an OKC, if you look at a Detroit, a San Antonio, a Minnesota, a Phoenix, a Houston, even a Toronto, Miami to a degree, there's a continuity within. We have personnel that understands what we do. We can do this on a nightly basis. And those are the teams that can sustain through the stretches, because it's hard to sustain defense in today's NBA. And it's hard to show up every single night and give that same level of effort. And the nights where you don't have it, there's a lot of teams that get blown out or beat in those days, in those nights. But the best defensive teams are able to use their base to sustain and find different ways. Are the Knicks a great defensive unit? No. But they have the activity and the effort, and they understand that when we do these things, we have success. When we don't, we get beat. Self-awareness is a big part of defense these days.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is right on it. Like, as you mentioned, some of the best defense in the league, as I think through who have I enjoyed watching the most, it starts with the Thunder. This is not a new take for me, for anyone that has listened to this podcast this season or really the last few seasons. But this Thunder group, to your point, Steve, they do such a good job. They have an established base. Like, there is just a level of physicality. There is just a level of activity they provide. There's a level of switchability that they have because they have so many guards that can defend different player types. Your Alex Caruso's in particular, you can put them on a little bit of anyone. That unlocks a level of versatility for you. That unlocks a level of aggression for you. It's a similar bit when healthy, Jalen Williams. We saw him make an all-defense team last year and was in the defensive player of the year conversation, at least on the fringes of it, because of his ability to guard up, which thus unlock, you know, Chet as a roamer if we want to do things like that, or if we're ramping up double teams, that's just more speed coming with the double teams. We can still have size on the back end of that. And so, like, watching OKC dictate terms to the degree that they have, they've been the best defense in the league with a gap this season. It's been a joy to watch. Like, their best possessions are when they are mixed again, a whole bunch of ball pressure, a whole bunch of off-ball physicality. You try to attack. There's a switch. There may be a peel switch if they need to. They're just swarming. They're collapsing the paint. You try to throw passes, they're going the other way with it. Like, they, at a high level, it reminds me of the Warriors offense. When you think about, like, the 15, 16 Warriors in that area, to where, okay, here's a 3-minute stretch where you actually just cannot do anything with us. Klay's having a shot making barrage, or Steph's going off. You're just not going to have a good time. The Thunder do that with their defense. You cannot dribble past us. You cannot pass around us. You cannot get shots up at the rim. You're not going to have a good time. This is a 12-0 run. This game is now officially over. Like, OKC has been such a fun time for me. Mention Phoenix. Mention Toronto. Like, San Antonio is an interesting one for me. Like, I think back to your Wimby breakdown that you had on the pod not too long ago. You also wrote about it. You've been talking about it all year long. And as we get into, like, some of the half-court defense trends for me, teams being more intentional about keeping their bigs low. Like, we have the cross-matching element of this. We can just put you on a non-shooter. But to the Wimby portion in particular, and you also see this with Philadelphia with Joel Embiid, OKC has been mixing this in. At least it feels like they've been mixing in more with Chet Holmgren, to where, no, you are just on the block. We were passed off assignments. Like, offenses may choose to, like, reconfigure their spacing or cut through and things like that. We may put a shooter in this corner to kind of complicate things. But no, I am staying low. I'm going to trust the rotations behind me, but we're going to keep our center's part near the basket. We're going to try to wall off the rim. Like, I feel like that is more of a thing that we're seeing, and I have enjoyed watching defenses try to dictate terms in that way to take away fruitful rim shots. But also, which is something that you brought up, Steve, how teams are looking to try to poke at that. Like, if this is what you want to do, how can we move that big around? Who can we put in that corner behind that big, to that point, kind of complicate some of those decisions there. But I do feel like that is something that is perking up. It just, I guess, tied to that, just the level of help teams want to show in general. Like, that also brings me back to OKC. But Miami, Boston, other teams that are willing to not only get into kind of peel switching from the corner. If there's a drive happening, I'm going to drop from the strong side corner sometimes. Pick up that drive. Someone behind me is going to fly to that corner so you don't have an easy kick out there. You'll see that from Boston. You'll see it from Miami. You'll see it from OKC. A lot more teams are starting to sprinkle it in. Golden State will also sprinkle it in as well. I think just the willingness for teams to showcase a level of activity and versatility from the strong side in general is something that has perked up for me. I guess I'll toss that question to you, Steve. Do you feel like that is on the rise, and how do you feel about the Gambit in general?
I mean, I think it's fun. I think teams are going to eventually adjust. So if you're a team that shows that all the time, my coach brain is activating right now. And so it's just, yes, it looks really clean when you nail that. And you hit that corner, you take that drive, the defender flows to the corner, it looks great. When you don't, it looks awful. And that's the thing people don't talk about. When you do not nail that switch, or someone's late, or there's a delay, it looks really bad. So it's a gamble to a degree. I don't necessarily know if it's going to be a wave, because eventually, you know, too many teams run empty corner actions. Too many teams clear outside. So, okay, if you're going to be a team that does that, then we'll just eliminate that option, and you'll just have to go back to kind of normal help to a degree. So, and ideally, you would like to be a team that's able to keep the ball in front and not have to have your strong side corner help and take the drive and flow. It's a great option to have if you are in danger, and I think the best teams execute it. It looks really good because it's clean. You take the drive, we float to the corner, we close back out, we're good. But I don't necessarily know if you want to have that baked in as a part of your base to a degree. I've seen, because Charlotte's really heavy on helping off of that corner. And it's like, well, it looks real good sometimes, looks real dangerous sometimes. And, you know, you leave that strong side corner open, you let a team game plan for you, knowing that you're going to help off that. You put yourself in some danger depending on who they put in next corner. So I always think with defense, you are more likely to have success if you are doing something that you want to do, if that makes sense. Making the rotations that you want to make, as opposed to, okay, we are having to do this. I think that's the distinction for me.
Okay. No, I think that's fair. Like, I think that is a difficult thing to pull off. You know what tripped me out is I was like, prepping for this segment, Steve, I was just looking at general defense stuff and looking for trends, things like that. My general thought, and that's what brought me back to the Steve Clifford clip in particular, was just like, it is just really hard to play defense these days. And I think there's just a common misconception that because the scores are high, that means that teams just are not defending. Like, there are games where there's like low effort or like low energy and those things happen. But in general, there's so much space to cover. Like, these guards are so good. As we discussed last week, the volume pick and rolls is down, but how high those screens are being set, it continues to creep up. That's just, again, more space to navigate. It complicates what coverages you want to get into based on all that stuff. So look at it clean in the glass. And the league average offensive rating this year, Steve, as of recording, is 115.6. That is your average this year. The 2015-16 Golden State Warriors, the team that won 73 games, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green making all the short roll things, the year that he shot well from three on top of that, the 15-16 Warriors had a 114.9 offensive rating. Like, league average is higher than the 15-16 Warriors per cleaning the glass. That is nuts to me, and just signifies like how difficult it is these days, how efficient offenses have gotten these days. Something that you highlight all the time, Steve, even the bad offenses know what to do when they get you in rotation. Like, it is just a tough job. And so, to your point, like, just having more tools in the toolkit just feels more important than ever today. You have to be able to take something off the table, or at least make offenses think more.
That you have to sustain. Today's NBA is about sustaining defense. No matter how you feel about a team, a lot of the bad teams can score, and you know that. And so if you have to defend more actions, you have to get back in transition, you're going to be put in action earlier in the clock, and you have to sustain as a team. And I think we've seen teams be able to defend well, but, you know, 18 seconds in, there's a breakdown. and now you can't get it back for a while. Like, we've seen stretches of good defense, even the Lakers, for example. I'm not even, we'll talk about them more in a little bit, but like, they have really good stretches of really good principal defense. It's just the fact that they can't sustain it and they can afford breakdowns. And so a lot of the teams you don't feel are good defensively are more so teams that, you know, effort may not be there. The scheme might be incorrect at times, but they are able to have the principles. They just can't afford a mistake. And I think that's a lot of what offenses do. We're going to force you to make a mistake. And that's the tricky part of it. Did you have any other trends or teams you wanted to shout, guys?
I think those are going to be the major ones for me. I guess this is in terms of quick shouts, because the Hornets have just been a very good defensive, statistically, in the month of January, in particular during the 7-game win streak that they're on. You alluded to what I was going to hit on if we got to a Charlotte bit, just how intentional they've been about shrinking the floor and showing help from a little bit of everywhere. And like, the Spurs game over the weekend was a great example of this. In that first half, or particularly in that first quarter, they're trying to help. They couldn't contain the ball. They're showing help everywhere. And it's just drives or kickouts, and the Spurs are getting good stuff. You get to the second half of that game, the screws were tightened. Ball containment was better. The switches were cleaner. And in general, you try to attack the basket, we are a little bit more selective with how much help we're showing. Like, we're doing it more on time, but it's not a full commit, so you don't have the same gap. So, like, even the Hornets, a mid-defense overall this year, they've been strong as of late because those principles are tying in. They're being more consistent with that. So I want to tie in the Charlotte bit very quickly. I will never forget the month of December for the Brooklyn Nets. Unfortunately, that seems that it's just going to be the high note of what they did defensively this year. So that bit is unfortunate. Other than that, I think we've talked about them in passing, so I think that'll do it for me. Steve, what has stood out to you on the defensive end?
Well, the number one thing I want to talk about is the Detroit Pistons and the way that they've defended consistently throughout the year, and the way that they have brought it every single night, to where we're just going to be a team that you have to deal with. It's not going to be fun. You're going to have to measure up to what we do. We're going to be physical. We're going to be active. We're going to get after you. So their activity on the defensive end on a nightly basis, when you're facing a team and they're ready and saying, hey, we're going to pressure you. And when you look and watch the Pistons off ball, they're touching bodies. They're working to keep drives in front. They are closing out. They're up to touch. It looks like you have an opening. You have a gap. You don't. You come to set a screen, there's someone right there in front of you. And so you put yourself in a position every single night where teams are having to earn baskets against the Pistons. And we're going to switch. There's going to be our bigs in the front. We're going to rotate. We're going to make it hard for you when you get in the paint. We're going to pressure the ball full court. And we're going to put ourselves in a position where you think that you have a lane. You think that something is open. You don't. We work to contain. We switch. You think there's movement and cuts. There are not. You think, okay, because we're staying at home, that we're aware, we're physical, we're active, we're taking things away, we're helping each other. And that is what separates them to me to a degree, is because every single night you watch them, it's not a perfect world for them, but you have to earn your baskets against this team, Nikias. Like, you're not going to get a free handoff, and we're going to get up in you if you don't get that handoff. And if you get another swing, we're going to be up in you and active. And yeah, you might get us late in the clock on a drive, but look at how much you had to do to get to that. That's where it separates from me. You know what I mean? Like, they just continuously put so much pressure on you, Nikias, every single night. Every single night they pressure teams and they are active. And I think it's the versatility they have with so many wings that can do different things, to where, okay, we can put you aside, we can switch, we can put a different wing on you, and we can contain the ball, we can test, and you're not going to have a good time. I think that's one of those things where you talk about teams that defend. Teams that defend can wear on you over the course of a 48-minute game. You know what I mean? And Detroit has been such a team where you get tired of being held and being touched and being pushed. So when you watch a Pistons game and you look at the off-ball defenders, they're staying home. But if you start moving, I'm going right to you. I'm getting into your body. I'm going to bother you. I'm fighting over a screen. You know, you think it's a drop, it's a game, it's a late switch. Now we've contained you. Now we're contesting. They put so much different kind of pressure on you. And even if you think, okay, we're getting a gap and I have free reign, no, you're in a different position to where we're putting our paws on you. When you think you have a driving lane and it's Jalen Duren or Isaiah Stewart who just decides, actually, that lane was fantastic, but we're going to go ahead and erase that. The rotations are pretty fantastic. So I want to salute the Detroit Pistons for finding a way to bring old school defense into today's NBA. And then, Nikias, quickly, I fell down a slight rabbit hole when it came to zone defense, and two zones in particular stood out to me. So Los Angeles Lakers are playing and mixing in a little bit more zone. It's a little bit more junk defense to a degree, and it's a little bit more, hey, can we hide our principles? And so we go, you know, the Lakers go 2-3, and the big is kind of the tell, but it's like we're switching, but we're kind of not switching, but it's a way for us to disguise that we're switching, but it's just a curveball. Like, it's not a true zone to a degree, but it is, you know, and then we can fake it, and then it's 2-3, and then, okay, you think we're in zone, but actually we're just switching again. So now back to my clock eating point, hey, can we get 10 seconds off the clock to just kind of disrupt and make you think we're doing something different? And I think it taps into something else. And I think for the Lakers, the thing they have to do, if with their zone man, they have to have principles where they, like, they can't afford breakdowns. That's the toughest part for them. But they can have enough of disruption and confusion to where, okay, we can kind of mix in the switching, mix in the help, mix in recovery, and make you think. I think that's a decent place for them to land on, because the defensive personnel is going to be the defense personnel. But if they can kind of navigate and figure out what to do and how to do it consistently, just get through a 2-3 minute stretch, especially during the regular season, and get this to a point where, okay, you don't necessarily know exactly what we're doing. We know what we're doing. I think they live there. Mm-hmm. The other one I wanted to quickly shout out on the zone front is the Minnesota Wolves zone, where Jaden McDaniels is out there with Naz Reid and Julius Randle, and it's just Jaden McDaniels in the middle. And I think it's one of the funniest things, because, like, made basket, Chris Finch will call it out, and then you just see pointing, and it's just Jaden McDaniels in the middle. And Jaden McDaniels is just, like, processing and, like, hey, I have one job, and that's to be in the middle of this. Hopefully this goes well. Everyone else figure it out around me. But my job is to be in the middle of this lane, and I'm going to point to everyone where y'all need to be, and hopefully no one comes towards me. If they do, I'm going to be in my spot. But hopefully this goes well for everyone else. And so it's like a man zone hybrid type beat that I've enjoyed. And I feel like they've had success with it. I think it's a good way to kind of protect Naz Reid and Julius Randle. And it's a good curveball. I don't know how much they use in the playoffs, but, like, watching Jay McDaniels patrol the paint has been really fun as they try and fly around around what he's doing. That's been pretty neat. So the biggest thing has been his communication and their ability to just kind of just try and disrupt in a different way. Not always a home run, but sometimes you don't need a home run defensively. You just need to have something in the back pocket. You need to be a pitcher with a different pitch. You need to have, you know, the ability to just kind of go play action pass. And that's kind of the fun part. I think zone usage has gone from, hey, this is what we do, to more so, we need to do something else. Let's try this. It's my mindset.
Okay, I got you. Three quick things from me on the zone front. I think you nailed it with the Lakers and the Wolves. The way they go about it has been interesting. Overall in the league, league average zone rate is about 2.9% this year. That is the second highest rate that we've seen since the 2013-14 season. Is at 3.1% during the 22-23 season. I think that was one of the more ridiculous Miami years in particular that helps bump that up, but that's what that is. There are six teams in the league right now with a zone rate over 5%. The Milwaukee Bucks, the Denver Nuggets, the Miami Heat, the Houston Rockets, particularly when they go double big, the Portland Trail Blazers, who also, at least earlier in the year, were doing some fun things with smaller lineups in their zone, and, as you highlighted, Steve, the Los Angeles Lakers, who, last note that I have, ran zone on about 2.5% of their possessions last year. That is up to 5.6% this year. It has very much become a bigger part of the Laker defensive diet, and as you highlighted so well, Steve, the way that they go about it is really interesting. So, I'll give a quick zone shout there. With that, we're going to take a break. And when we return, we have unrivaled thoughts from the weekend and also some unrivaled news. We have the 1v1 tournament player pool, Steve. Excited to dig into them with you. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we are back, and Steve, it is time to talk Unrivaled, fresh off of historic Friday, where games were played in Philadelphia. Record-setting crowd, over 21,000 people were present for the Philly Unrivaled games on Friday night. All-time record for a regular season pro women's basketball game. Most attended event ever in Xfinity Mobile Arena history. that includes concerts, whatever you want to name, that figure is the highest ever. So just a general sense to how awesome that is.
You gotta stand on that. It's more than the Indiana Fever and the Mystics. It's more than in that building when Michael Jordan was a Chicago Bull. It's more than the Backstreet Boys, Nikias. Now, I know when the Backstreet Boys were out, you were like, what, four? But
that's crazy.
This is why Unrivaled is so important, and the energy that was displayed in that building, the warmth, the joy, that's why this exists. And that's why everyone watches women's sports, and that's why we need this every single year. So it's a big tip of the cap to what they did, and I enjoyed every single minute of it.
Oh, right there with you. We talked a little bit about it in the lead up, just how excited Natasha Cloud and Kalia Copper were in particular to bring so many of their teammates and just the league itself to Philadelphia, experience some of the things they grew up with, and for the crowd to show up the way it did. So many celebrities were there. Was not expecting to get like an Andre Drummond in-game interview as he's fan grew up with Marina Mabry or around Marina Mabry. So that was a fun counter or a fun thing sprinkled in, but the games itself was fantastic. And to Marina Mabry,
yeah.
Steve.
Yeah. It's time for you, Nikias, to acknowledge Marina Mabry. They got close to Jersey. And let me tell you, would you like to score 21 points? I would also, as a whole person, like to score 21 points. And that's what Marina Mabry did. League record, cooking. And that first quarter was insanity. Go ahead. I'm listening.
No, you're good. Just bouncing off of that, Steve. Because, like, you see the graphic or you see the highlights, it's like, holy crap, Marina Mabry go off. You need to watch this game. Because Marina missed, I think, her first two or three shots of that game. This was an immediate turnaround and explosion. And it was just rude pull-up after rude drive after rude pull-up after rude three after rude pull-up after rude drive. And she is jawing after every basket she makes. And you blink and it's like, okay. Because like the Rose had an early lead in this game. And then you blink and it's like, oh, well, the Lunar Owls are not only winning, they have literally all of the momentum because of this ridiculous shot-making stretch from Marina Mabry. And then it just kept going, Steve. It kept going. And so, like, I didn't get to watch the game live. I had church things on Friday night. And so I saw the box score and stuff like that. I was like, and I was trying to track the play-by-play towards the end of the game. I was like, do they know that she's close to 50? They have to get her 50. What's going on? Now, I actually watched the game the next morning. You see, like, she took, like, a shot late in that fourth quarter, so she was out for a little bit. They came back, and I was like, oh, okay, so that's why they weren't funneling her shot. She still ends up with the game-winning basket, so, like, naturally, that just had to be how that capped off. But, oh, my, I was incredibly impressed with the shot-making performance of Marina Mabry and the myriad of ways that she got her basket. She absolutely deserves her respect for that outing, which kind of leads me to the other thing that I wanted to hit on, like, major theme, as the Rose lose this game. And then we get the rubber match between the Rose and the Breeze. And Paige Beckers was incredibly rude to everyone. And there was this one possession late in the first quarter. The rip through Paige had against Lexi Hall, she had her arm extended, gets it to go. And then as she's going back, you know, as she's going to the free throw line, she's like, she's like, points her head. Like, I don't know if that was like something for her. I don't know if that was like a, hey, use your head. Don't have your hands in the cookie jar bit. I don't know. I didn't get to ask about it. But I was like, oh, my.
For any long-term dunkers, it does tie into a clip that we had earlier this unrivaled season.
Hoo-wee.
I'll leave it there.
Yeah, that's it.
I got in trouble.
Yeah, we'll leave it right there. But no, Paige Beckers is the same. Like, the Breeze, they lose to the Phantom. Going back to the Friday game. And Paige Beckers was good in that game, but I was listening to some of the post-game commentary from that one. And Renee Montgomery was like, hey, Paige, very good at basketball. Sometimes you just have to be more aggressive. Like, you should just be leading your team in shot attempts. Like, there shouldn't be many games where two or three players on your team are taking more shots than you. You always want to make the right play. You always want to take good shots. I understand it. But sometimes a bad shot from you is better than a good shot from someone else, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very funny to, like, watch that game, hear that commentary, and then watch the Breeze Rose game where Paige then drops 32 points. it just has all the mid-range baskets. Again, had that rip through against Lexi Hole, but it's drives, 2 of 4 from three on top of that. It's like, ah, that's tough. But broader point, to circle back, I am concerned about DeRozan. And I sprinkled this in where, yeah, because like I sprinkled this in early this year where I'm like, hey, Chelsea Gray has been incredible. It's been insane what she's been able to do from a shot-making perspective. What she's been able to do defensively when she's matched up with bigger players, getting the strips, that's a carryover from the W season. But I've always kind of had, like, it's incredible that she's having these performances. DeRozan should not need this level of Chelsea Gray to be able to win games. She shouldn't have to be at an A-plus all the time for them to be able to function. And, like, to be fair, like, in that Breeze matchup, there was no Azaree Stevens in this one. The Breeze didn't have Cam Brink either. But they were down to bigs. That obviously messes with what your rotations are going to be and stuff like that. But the offense can get bogged down, especially when teams are putting more length on Chelsea Gray. We're going to fix in some full-court pressure. You've seen that more as of late. Like, Chelsea is good enough to deal with it, but with an 18-second shot clock, she's having to work harder for those looks. I think teams are also being a little bit more intentional about let's get a screen early to get her switched onto our ball handler and now it's flowing to a pick and roll. Again, Chelsea can make plays out of that, but it just feels like her workload offensively is already super high and now defenses are poking at that with pressure and length. And then we're also putting her in action on the other end. And so you just get to like these second quarters or these third quarters where it's like, oh, well, Chelsea just doesn't have it right now. Who else is picking up the slack? And to this point, no one has consistently done so. Kalia Copper's had her moments, but like no one's consistently done so. And so they need to get the defense in order. They need to find a way to make life a little bit easier on Chelsea. You want to see just more consistently from the others on that front. Because as you see in the Breeze matchup, when she has a night where she's not making jumpers, that's transition opportunities the other way, and it just gets kind of hazy. So I'm just kind of keeping an eye on what that balance is.
Well, I mean, I think Shakir Austin's had a pretty solid season, Shakir. Some high points. I think Kyle's working her way back in. So that could be the difference for the Rose. I mean, it's a competitive league. It's 3-on-3, and you beat teams, and you keep playing well, teams are going to go after you. I'll go rapid fire here quickly. Are we ready for the Phantom run, by the way? Are we ready for the Aaliyah Boston post-up, Kelsey Plum? Also, Natasha Cloud, salute for the dive to save that game. Set up the game winner in Philly. Mm-hmm. But are you ready for the Phantom run?
Yeah. Like we talked about their balance last week. Like, yeah, they're very good. Kelsey Plum can do a little bit of everything. Defense don't know quite what to do with her. Leah Boss has been incredibly good. And you just kind of flow from there. Like they are a very good team. They're a dangerous group.
Okay. Next question. Are you ready to deal with the games where the Mist can't score? Because I was watching them play the Laces, and the Laces are just an absolute, hey, we have Alyssa Thomas, Jackie Young, Brittany Sykes. Would you like to compete? We're not going to make it fun for you. And it was very much, hey, what happens if the Mist can't score? Hey, why can't the Mist score? Hey, they're not scoring. The fact that they were able to get back in that game was a miracle based on how it started.
Insane.
Are you ready for the reality where the Mist just can't score the basketball?
Like not yet. Like I felt like that game was more, I am impressed with what the Laces are doing more so than anything structural with the Mist, at least right now. Cause I think they've been such a good driving / we poke at your smaller players team so far this year. Like I had my complaints about the season opener with them. It was like, hey, the second quarter is just a whole bunch of post-ups. Can we not do that? But like, this feels like the first quote unquote bad Alicia Gray game that we've gotten all year. So like, I'm not super concerned on that front. I think they'll be able to drive. They'll get to the free throw line. I keep an eye on the 3-point shooting for sure. But overall, like I'm not there with them. Like I don't have scoring concerns. Like I don't have put them in the same bucket as like the Vinyl, for example, who the Vinyl also bouncing back and getting a couple of
key wait. Hold on. Cause that was my next question. Are we ready to respect the Vinyl? Are we ready to acknowledge the scoring prowess of Ray Burrell?
I have strong respect for the Vinyl's defense, which Ray Burrell plays. Ray Burrell's just everywhere. It has been everywhere all year long. Like one of the first things I had in my notes, you know, tracking this season to being in Miami, it's like, hey, these are a whole lot of cuts and a whole lot of offensive rebounds for Ray Burrell. And so the fact that she is still doing that, she's stealing everything. Like she doesn't mind mixing up, diving for loose balls or just playing the passing lanes. When she does have the drives and some of these pull up turnaround middies and she is able to knock down spot up threes, it's like, oh, well, this is just like a 6'2 wing that can do a little bit of everything and that can pop in this kind of format. She had a huge weekend. And so, like, I still do have my general, like, what is your offensive process in the half court questions. But they can poke at things defensively. They are incredibly annoying to try to score against. And now, as you're seeing them sprinkling a little bit more of, like, Brittany Griner, and teams have to decide, are we doubling this, are we not? Like, they have avenues. So I want to see them continue to build on that.
Okay. Thank you. My last question, my final question. How much did Alyssa Thomas want to beat the Mist? Because she took 11.
Brother. The answer is yes, Steve. The answer is yes. Because, like, the thing with Alyssa Thomas, like, to your point, she hasn't taken a lot of shots on a per-game basis this year. Also, you just look, you watch those games and or just look at those box scores. Like, it's a whole lot of Alyssa Thomas 9 minutes, Alyssa Thomas 11 minutes, Alyssa Thomas 8 minutes, Alyssa Thomas 12 minutes. Nah, 18 was just here for this one. 9 of 11 inside the arc. Her usual blend of I'm putting my shoulder into your chest. And, hey, yes, I think she wanted that. I think she lives up for these kind of matchups where this is a whole bunch of physicality. There's a star forward on the other side. We're going to have all of our fun. So, yeah.
Fantastic. And speaking of fun, our fun is done. Get us out of here before they mix us up.
Okay, well, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. That's where you can find all of our awesome content. You can follow me on socials at TheKaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week. Happy trading.